We were watching a movie made by a high schooler. A teenage girl playing a local TV news personality walks to her minivan after work. She's just informed Kansas City of a rash of crimes committed by teens with pantyhose on their heads. As she fumbles for her keys in the dark, she's approached.
Miss O'Neill, you're getting too close to our operation. Keep your nose out of our business.
I'm sorry, it's just my job.
Well, maybe you should reevaluate the importance of your job.
That's when everything goes dark.
No!
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or four Kansas City kids dressed like them, have saved the day.
We were audacious! Gnarly! Tubular! Oh, excellent! Hi-ya!
This movie might seem silly, but it got Alex Hoy into film school at USC. Now he's coming home with a new movie, a polished, professional, grown-up movie for the Kansas City Film Festival next weekend. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And Alex, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thank you. That was the best intro I've ever had in my life, I think.
I'm so happy to hear that. How many years has it been since you made that Ninja Turtles movie in Kansas City?
Gosh, we made that senior year of high school, so we were a bunch of 18-year-olds running around. That was in 2004, so, 13 years ago now, which is kind of crazy.
What inspired you to do it? I mean, other than, I assume, really liking the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, I grew up in that era that we kind of had an unhealthy obsession with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I don't think that era is over, actually.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And the, when I was in high school, we had a really great broadcast journalism school at my high school at Blue Valley North is where I went to school. And they put a camera in my hands, and I just picked up on the language of visual storytelling really intuitively, more so than a lot of my other classmates, and kind of quickly became known as the guy to go to for great videos.
Why do high schoolers go to each other for great videos? I mean, they do, and I remember that, but it's kind of weird.
Well, yeah, I would make videos for people for class projects. I would make videos for, I was in a youth group where they always wanted to make funny videos. I just think video and the kind of visual storytelling is a very easy way to get people together and to get people interested in sometimes things that people wouldn't necessarily be interested in.
Okay, but I want you to tell me a little bit more about running around in, like, teenage is young for making movies, maybe, but it's kind of old for running around in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle costumes.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And so I knew when my senior year came around that I really wanted to do something big, because I had made all these videos and people kind of looked to me and my little group of friends as the guys that did that. And we had made this little Mario Brothers music video that had been very popular, where we just cut in some footage from the video games and stuff like that. Right, exactly. So we had done that, and that had been so popular that we thought, like, well, let's take another childhood favorite and make something fun. And at first it started as an idea of like, oh, it'll just be kind of a 5 to 10 minute thing. But we made these like amazing costumes, which are actually made from buttericks that were my mom sewed, that were made for children's costumes in the 80s. And she just increased the size.
But wait, what are they made from? I didn't quite understand that.
So they used to make these outlines of costumes that then you could buy, and then you could make them yourself.
Oh, like patterns.
Yeah, it was a pattern, exactly. And so my mom, we found like an old one from like 1988 that was, you know, for a Ninja Turtle costume if you wanted to make one for yourself. And they were these ridiculous costumes where you made a shell that you threw over your head, and our faces were actually, I think you saw, in the heads of the stuffed heads of these turtles. Once we had that, and they looked so, they were ridiculous, but at the same time, kind of glorious.
Yeah, was it fun?
It was amazing. And so we had the time of our life doing the first kind of 5 minutes, which you were just playing. And we said, let's just remake the whole movie on a smaller scale, which we ended up doing. And it ended up being like almost 45 minutes long. And because we had been kind of those guys that made videos, we were able to get like 300 people to come see it. And before we went off to college, and we had this big premiere, and we came out in the costumes and signed autographs as the turtles. It was, it was a circus for sure. But it was the time of our life. We had a blast doing it.
I'm going to get back to your work soon, but can you explain something to me about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
I'll do my best.
What is, in your opinion, why does the concept behind that whole thing, like, why does it work? Whoever thought of it is clearly a genius, but it
right.
still doesn't actually make sense to me that the idea of a cartoon about four turtles named after Renaissance painters who
right.
fight crime and like pizza is as popular and enduring as it has been.
Yeah, it's hard. You are very much... onto something that I think a lot of people have asked themselves about the Ninja Turtles, for sure, because it's a very strange concept. And I think, for me, it was the cartoon that hit like right at the right time for me. And for whatever reason, I couldn't get enough of their adventures. And there was always such goofiness surrounding it. But for me, I always look back to that first movie that we kind of remade as this really interesting work, because it was actually really gritty and serious. And I think that kind of gave people this idea that, like, hey, these Ninja Turtles, they have, you know, they really have something to say. Whereas after that, you know, every other movie that's been made, most of the cartoons and the shows, everything has been very lighthearted and kind of goofy.
But wait, what do you think it is they have to say?
I think that the personalities of the turtles themselves, I think, must be what connect with people, because it's like, you know, they take four very generic kind of tropes of personality types, and like the leader, the kind of nerdier dork, the serious kind of guy, and the party animal. And
oh my god, wait, it's Wizard of Oz and Seinfeld. And
right, exactly. I think that they have really strong character makeup that people, especially I think kids connected with at that time, and they've been able to kind of build off of that and take their product way further than I'm sure Eastman and Laird ever thought it would go, who are the creators.
Well, okay, so your new movie, Prodigy, is just, I would say, totally unrecognizable from the one about the Ninja Turtles. And that makes sense. It's been 13 years and
right.
you've been to film school. But it's a thriller full of mind games, and it's mostly set in one room with two people in conversation with one another and creepy music making it super intense. Would you agree with that description?
I would agree with that description. That is an apt description of the makeup of the work.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the movie. We have two clips of the scene where our two main characters first meet. James Fonda is a psychologist who's been brought in by a frustrated team of experts who are trying to deal with an extremely dangerous little girl named Eleanor. This psychologist is kind of a last resort, since the previous people they've brought in have not been able to handle her. The little girl is in a straitjacket under strict surveillance, and she's just given the new guy a thorough evaluation. There are people in another room watching everything going on between them, and the little girl has noticed everything. The psychologist's sweater vest, his tattered briefcase, even his posture.
That was quite an evaluation, Eleanor.
Don't call me Eleanor.
What should I call you?
Ellie is better.
All right. Ellie does suit you.
Spare me your pandering. I'm well beyond your usual trust-building exercises.
I agree. Again.
Then let's skip the formalities and get straight into it, shall we?
Into what?
You are an analyst, are you not?
I am.
And you have my file?
I do.
And you've got nothing for me? No diagnosis?
Well, perhaps I'm not as perceptive as you. But, to be honest, I haven't even read this.
Is that right?
Relax. He's bluffing. He wouldn't go in there blind.
It is.
Is this common practice for you? Arriving woefully unprepared?
If I had read this, it would have colored my perception of you before we met. Personally, I prefer to hear from the individual in question, rather than focusing on a particular problem they have or mistake they made.
Even if said individual is a maladjusted prepubescent?
All the more so with children.
Dude. I mean, tell me about that scene from your perspective.
That scene is kind of the, we kind of built the movie around this reveal of this young, like we like to call her, our little miniature Hannibal Lecter, because we really felt like putting a young person into that role in, and I mean, really staking the movie on that and letting them carry the movie with that personality would be something that would be a really strong hook and that would really be effective in terms of getting people interested in a movie that was always going to be a little smaller than the big boys.
But so I guess, like, thinking about a little kid in the role of a Hannibal Lecter type character, like the criminal who sort of resists, I don't know, intervention in a way, because he right. always turns the tables and turns himself into the analyst, kind of.
Right.
Why? What's different about a child in that role?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, so the young lady whose name is Savannah Lyles is, she was 9 years old while we were shooting. And so I think the obvious thing that's different is that she's so young and people don't expect her to be able to, I mean, compete intellectually with an adult, especially one who is, you know, a doctor. And so I think that was always the strongest hook for me, was to see this young, you obviously have this young girl strapped to this chair in a straitjacket when you come in, which immediately raises a number of questions as to what's going on here. And then when she starts to talk, it only compounds upon that with this kind of hyper intelligence that she presents. And I always felt that that would be the strongest element of getting people interested in our story, I think.
Well, just, I mean, at the very beginning of their interaction, it feels just dramatically like she's got the upper hand. He hasn't gotten through a single sentence when she starts telling him about himself. But then he takes this reference she makes to herself as a maladjusted prepubescent and throws it back at her with this, all the more so with children. I mean, I just feel like I can already tell that this character does not like being called a child.
Yes, that's an astute observation. She definitely does not like being, I think, observed as a child in general, because that's kind of the personality we gave her, was one of somebody who feels like they're above everyone, including the adults in her life. And she's having trouble adjusting to that because it makes her so different and alienates her so much, especially from her own peer group. But, I mean, you can see even in the movie, it has alienated her even from the adults who are trying to intervene there as well. And, yeah, I think that edge she has is what gives her this initial kind of intrigue as a character. And then I think it falls to the other character, the psychologist, to then prove that he can keep up with her.
And then these people in the other room, I mean, I feel like they actually weirdly bring these two characters together on the same team because they're so judgmental of him. I mean, her assessment of him as a bargain bin find it's an attitude you can tell these other people who are observing them kind of share. But they can't seem to make any progress with her, and she's trying to defy them. So if the two of them succeed together, it'll show them all, right?
Well, right, except that she's kind of fighting against that progress because the progress that the psychologist hopes to make, which is to break through with her and get to the soft underbelly of beneath this hard shell she's putting forth, she doesn't want him to get there. So I think she's kind of pushing back against that. So, I mean, the way I look at it is that the experts in the room and her are both kind of pushing against him, and he has to remain steadfast and carry himself all the way through. And he gets thrown back on his heels a little bit when he kind of figures out what the situation actually is all about.
Well, let's hear what comes immediately after the part we just heard. This is Eleanor and her psychologist, James Fonda.
I was right about you.
You were right about a lot of things. I have worked with children, often from rough neighborhoods, and I'm not particularly concerned with my hairstyle. I don't believe, however, that qualifies me as a bargain bin find.
The other shrinks they brought me were designer suits and fancy watches.
A watch is a funny device these days. I have a friend who was obsessed with fancy watches. Eventually, after years of hard work, he rewarded himself with one, and it was beautiful. The problem was, after about a week, it was nearly 2 minutes slow. He wound it, set it, another week went by, same problem. He was always losing time. You know, my father gave me this watch a long time ago. It's not flashy by any means. But I'll tell you what, it's never lost a minute. Yeah, a timepiece may have aesthetic value. At its core, though, it is a single function device. Shiny or dull, all that matters is how well it tells the time.
And you can tell the time?
Never lost a minute.
You stand to lose more than time in here.
Well, I'm willing to take that chance if you are.
Perhaps. But certainly not on an empty stomach.
And so now he's got to make her a sandwich. I mean, what you notice, I mean, obviously we are just listening, but when you have a movie that is mostly two people in a room, sound takes on kind of an important dimension because it seems like you need to work with everything you've got under those conditions.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah, that was a huge consideration for us because, again, like you said, we have two people in a room. And visually, we knew we were going to have to make that feel as different as we could and constantly be moving the camera around and making sure that it never felt static. But then sound was a huge deal, and we got a great sound designer who worked on it with us and really made it a lot better than it would have been had we not had him on board, because he really just infused it with so much going on beneath the surface. There's kind of an atmosphere in the room. There's you can hear the ticking of the watch and the little things here and there as they go along. But yeah, it's a huge part of the movie. And I think it was something that we used to make the movie what it is. Thanks to much thanks to the sound, I think.
Alex, we got to take a break, but we're going to get right back to Alex's movie, Prodigy, which will be showing in the Kansas City Film Fest next weekend. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll return in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking to Kansas City native Alex Hoy about his new movie, Prodigy. Hi again, Alex.
I'm here. Thank you for having me back.
I'm glad you're here. You have made this movie that we've been talking about, and I feel like people should know that the storyline is just really, truly creepy. I mean, the main character, Eleanor, has done something to end up in a straitjacket with entire teams of experts studying her under strict surveillance. Are you willing to tell our listeners what that is?
I think that it's worth mentioning that it's one of the major influences on this movie was the old kind of Twilight Zone and Outer Limits kind of episodes from way back when.
What about those?
Well, because we knew that, like you said earlier, we were working within a constrained space and with only a handful of characters, and we wanted to do that well, and we knew we'd have to rely on the kind of science fiction, the heady science fiction that relies more on the sharp dialogue and depth of character, that those are the elements that really made the best Twilight Zone episodes. And so that's kind of the way the movie is set up, is to be that way and to let the audience slowly peel back the layers of what's going on here. And as those layers come off, it quickly starts to be revealed that there is obviously, like you said, something more sinister going on here. This little girl is in here because she has done something that these people perceive as almost completely evil. And then as well, like some science fiction elements start kind of seeping into that as well. And things get a lot more exciting than just two people in a room talking by the end.
Eleanor, or Ellie, has a very particular appearance. Can you talk to me about casting, not just her character, but the others as well?
Yeah, so Eleanor was the first... When we finished the script, it took us about a year to get the script to a point where we felt really good about it. And we knew the first thing we were going to have to do is cast a young actor to fill this role. And the role was actually written for a boy initially.
Huh.
And we had a bunch of casting sessions with boys, and we weren't really getting what we wanted out of them. And we weren't feeling very confident that we could pull off the vision we had for the character with these actors. And we were almost ready to say, okay, maybe we should scale this back a little bit so that we can actually pull this off. And we had a conversation, and eventually we're like, okay, why not open the casting to girls too? Because there's no reason it couldn't be. And the first day, this young lady, Savannah Lyles, submitted, and she blew us away with just a tape that she sent in. And to be honest, we got 10 girls in that first day that were better than any of the boys, which hurt our pride a little bit as boys, but it made the decision easy to change it to a girl. And once we had her on board, I mean, she had, like you said, she has an amazing look as well. She has the freckles and the red hair.
She has so many freckles.
She has so many freckles. And a lot of people have asked us if we actually added freckles in post, but we didn't. They're all real. But once we had her, we really felt like we had a movie. And we moved on and started casting the other roles. And Richard Neal is the actor who plays Dr. Fonda, who is the psychologist. And he was kind of our second main priority. And he's like my hero. He's a great actor. He was amazing on set. He was a consummate professional. He was the only person who had to be there all the time. And he always had a good attitude and kept everything light on set. And then he delivered it such a great performance as well. And the story on his casting was that we had the Fonda's reading a very emotional scene from the end. And he was the only one who read, and me and my partner both looked at each other, and neither of us had any notes. And so we were like, okay, that's good. Thank you. And he didn't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing. But when he got the call the next week, I think he knew it was a good thing.
What kind of resources were you working with making this movie? I mean, you're a person who, I mean, it might seem like a long time ago to you that it was 13 years ago that you made a pretty silly Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie where you were running around in a costume through the streets of Kansas City as a teenager. But like 13 years from that, and you're making a movie with casting calls and stuff like that. I mean,
right. The process has definitely changed. That was us, you know, it went from a bunch of yahoos in the backyard, you know, shooting with their home video camera to, a full-on crew in an actual set and with all the elements involved. But it's interesting because on this level, operating at such an indie level, you're still wearing so many hats. So the process itself has changed, but it doesn't necessarily feel that different because, you know, I was still the one we built the set ourselves. We went out and bought all the wardrobe and the props and everything that you see on screen and all the furniture and all the set decor, everything. We did all of that. So it doesn't necessarily feel like it's evolved too much because we were still wearing so many of those hats and doing so many of those jobs on set. But at the same time, you know, it's a totally different experience making a movie this way because you do have, you know, we were working with a much higher fidelity cameras and we had an actual crew. It wasn't just, you know, on Ninja Turtles, we would set the camera up and go run in front of it and then come back and check it afterwards. So it was definitely a step up from that.
What do you know about movie making now that you didn't know then and maybe wouldn't have even imagined back then?
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about that because when I made Ninja Turtles, I hadn't even really studied movies at all at that point. And that was just kind of this instinctual endeavor that I really felt like I could pull off. And I ended up going to USC and have continued to just be a movie connoisseur since. So I really feel like it's the exposing myself to so many different kinds of movies and so many different places and so many different people that have so many different ideas and distinct visions that has really developed my own instincts and my own taste, which has really defined my style as a filmmaker.
Can you give an example of a movie that you saw that blew your mind, not just as an audience member, but as someone trying to do this who
Yes.
discovered something new, like a new tool that you put in your toolkit?
Absolutely. So I have the best example of that is I would always, throughout college, I became kind of obsessed with The Godfather, the first movie. And
you're not alone.
I know. Everyone loves The Godfather, and I'm aware of that. But I used to watch it so many times, and I was so aware of how thorough it felt as a movie. Because to me, it feels different than some of my other favorite movies because it just feels like every shot, every line, every moment, every transition has been so thoroughly crafted. And I couldn't really put my finger on what made that happen. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I read a bunch of behind the scenes and watched a bunch of featurettes and I couldn't figure it out. And finally, on the special edition DVD, when it came out, there was a little feature called Francis Ford Coppola's Notebook. And it showed him opening this notebook he had that he used on set, which was he had taken every page of the novel and torn it out, pasted it onto a piece of white paper, and written detailed notes on every single page, every line by line almost. How am I going to cover this? What would Hitchcock do if this was him? He had all these different ideas. And then he did that for the entire novel. And then at the end of each scene, he did a breakdown of every scene and what here. This is the core of the scene. This is the characters within the scene and what's happening to them. Here are the pitfalls that we could fall into. If we don't do this right, the scene will not work. And I found that such an inspiring thing to me because this feeling I got from watching that movie was really created just by him putting that time in.
Alex Hoy. Thorough. That is awesome. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Gina. It's been a pleasure, and I hope to see you guys next week at the festival.
Yeah, Alex's movie Prodigy will be showing at the Kansas City Film Festival April 7th and 8th. Up next, we'll hear from a book designer whose work is included in a new exhibit, plus a musician with a different take on what a love song's all about. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now Tom Eichemans. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tom is a book designer, and that's a creative endeavor that we all notice on some level as readers, but maybe don't stop to think about, because before you know it, we're totally absorbed in whatever it is we're reading. But Tom's work is part of an exhibit. It's the Book Jacket and Journal Show put on by the Association of American University Presses. It's in Lawrence for another week. And Tom, have you seen the whole show?
I have. It's always pretty interesting to see the collection of all the work that's put out by university presses from around the country. And so this is an especially interesting year to see what kind of work has been produced.
Why is this year especially interesting?
Well, it's the 10th year that I've been in university press publishing, and I've also recently switched to an art book publisher. And so it kind of felt like the culmination of, for me personally at least, a lot of the work that I had been leading up to kind of culminated in this show.
What do you see in the work on the whole, kind of as a book designer, that those of us who aren't designers might not notice?
Well, what's kind of interesting about university presses is that they kind of have maybe a reputation for being really dry and maybe not as exciting in a visual sense. When you see a book cover for, you know, a book about some ancient historical event or something that might not be quite as exciting as a bestseller. But what I've started to notice over the past 10 years or so is that university presses have started to adopt some of the methods that maybe more mainstream publishers have used and brought in some more creative approaches to how their books have been designed and how the covers have turned out. And I think it's been really exciting to see how presses have brought themselves up and are able to kind of stand at the same level as some really high-end design that you might see elsewhere.
One of your books is called Black Women in Sequence, Re-inking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. And it's being promoted as the first detailed investigation of Black women's participation in comic art. Tell me more about that book first, and then we'll talk about your design.
I was so excited to work on this book because it's not often that comics or illustrated books or graphic novels are dealt with as a topic by university presses. And so when this book came up, I jumped at the chance to work on it. There were two designers at the press, and we often decide who's going to work on each project. And I threw my hat in the ring for this one pretty early on. This one was really interesting to work on. There was a lot of visual imagery. The author was really engaged in the process, and it was a really collaborative effort working with her, the editor who brought the book in, and the various artists that were involved as well, were even involved with some of the details of the book. The image that was chosen for the cover was a detail from a classic comic strip that ended up kind of representing what the book became as a whole. It covered the whole span of how Black women have been represented in comics from the earliest times that comics started to appear all the way up to the present, and is divided in some thoughtful chapters to kind of explore how that's progressed over time.
Are you into comics as just a reader?
I am, yes.
What did you learn in the book that surprised you just reading it?
Well, I think kind of taking a step back and considering how and why certain characters might be represented in a comic or a graphic novel. It's kind of easy to look at a comic and assume that everything's in place because it's been drawn, but this forces you to take a step back and consider why characters may have been included or why they may have been written into the story from a perspective that's maybe a little bit more unexpected, I think, than if you just assume that it's the way it's always been.
What were the challenges in this project for you as a designer?
I felt like this particular project I could identify with in the sense that it's about comics, and I like comics and art and graphic novels. The challenges I had, I think, were that it's about Black women, and I'm neither of those. And so finding ways to kind of respectfully approach that subject while still maintaining kind of an interesting approach were certainly a challenge as well.
How did you deal with that?
Simply by talking to the author, really learning the subject, reading the book, getting into the different materials. I think learning as much as I could and exposing myself to the various, details and histories and everything that's all involved in putting the book together.
Is there a specific detail that you just love?
I think it's got to be the cover.
Describe it.
It's an image of a woman in a kitchen, and it's an image that the author actually suggested. And it's not maybe the first one that I would have picked. There are a lot of more recent comics that might be more familiar or recognizable, but the author felt like this particular image was one that really captured what she was trying to get at in her novel. And so it was originally published in black and white in a newspaper. I believe it was from the 50s or 1960s.
Somewhere in the mid-century.
Yeah, like late mid-century and kind of a time of turmoil already. And so the image is already loaded because she's kind of in a domestic scene. But at the same time, she's kind of confronting those kind of aspects by, she just has, the way that she's drawn is very at odds with the environment that she's in. And something about that juxtaposition really kind of ended up making a really strong cover.
Tell me how she's drawn.
She's just drawn in, ink, black line ink style, like any comic you'd expect. But what was kind of interesting to do with the image is that since it was black and white originally, I chose to color in just the figure. So we created different tones for her clothing and her skin and hair, and then left the background just in pure black and white. And so in a way, kind of the design kind of gimmick that we gave to it was by adding color into the image, we kind of enriched her as a person while making the background recede into the kind of a less prominent position.
Your cover for a book called The Holding Hours is getting recognition as well. It's a book of poetry about the author's journey caring for her daughter who has a neurological injury. And the cover is very pretty, but I have the feeling that it's referencing something that I don't fully understand. Maybe something sciency? I don't know. Can you describe the cover and explain it to me?
So I'm glad you noticed this one. This is one of the favorite covers that I've worked on. It's actually a collection of poetry, and it's called The Holding Hours by Christiane Balk. And it's kind of explores several different subjects. One is her daughter's illness and kind of experience going in and out of hospitals and clinics and dealing with the range of emotions and experiences through that. But then it kind of is interspersed with these poems about the natural world and kind of exploring forests and rivers and natural environments. And so by going back and forth between them, I felt like a cover that kind of felt a little bit scientific or clinical, balanced with something that had a natural element, would really be a successful solution. And so this was a really fun project to work with because I decided to collaborate with a friend of mine who is artistic as well, and she works at a plant shop. And so I asked her if she might illustrate the cover using leaves of a plant that she had. And so what the final cover is the letters for the holding hours are spelled out of ferns and just placed on a solid white background. So it feels really scientific in that sense, but it also kind of has this richness of the natural world.
Yeah, I thought it might have been a drawing of something smaller within, like something microscopic, but now that you say it, those are totally fern leaves.
They're totally fern leaves.
Well, you know, I'm curious how you define design. I have a designer friend who once told me that design is all about making your own rules and then following them.
That is certainly one way to do it. There's no right way to be a designer, but they're kind of two fundamental ways that design could be approached. And one is that the designer themselves is an artist and contributes a creative kind of flavor or direction to the design. The designer's presence is certainly felt in the design, maybe even just as prominent as the content itself. And then the other approach is where the designer is more of an anonymous background kind of presence that organizes things, makes things look good and legible, and makes the whole kind of output really clear and easy to approach. There's a theory in design that's classic called the crystal goblet, where the design is the crystal goblet. You don't really see it, but it's elegant and holds the water and or wine or whatever's in the goblet. And
depending on the time of day, perhaps.
Exactly. Or coffee, which is what I have in my goblet right now. And so I kind of struggle back and forth between those two ends, because I like and I'm drawn to the artistic output, but often, like, as my job really is to communicate either an author or a client's message into something that's visual, sometimes I have to step out of the way and just make it legible and clear and make the message easy to communicate.
I feel
whereas
like,
at other times, oh, go ahead.
Well, that might get even more complicated when you're doing art books, because you're at that point also working with another artist's vision.
That's exactly true. And it's a different way of approaching things, because often with more scholarly books, there may not be any imagery to work with, in which case I might have to do image research or kind of generate a more conceptual approach to how the design might be achieved. Or it may have a historical photo or a really specific image associated with it. Whereas art books, you're given all the imagery.
And you kind of can't mess it up.
No, I definitely cannot mess it up. But it's more of the crystal goblet approach, where the art has to be foremost and my design has to support it. And whether it's through typography or layout, there are all sorts of kind of behind the scenes decisions that are put into place to make it stand out and look the best that it can.
Tom Eichemans, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
And now, Calvin Arsenia calls his music neoclassical urban folk. His signature instrument is a harp. But after attending the International Folk Alliance conference here in Kansas City a few years ago, Calvin decided to pick up a more typical folk instrument, the banjo, to write an Americana love song to his hometown. Here's Calvin with the story of that song, Kansas City, Baby.
I just fell in love with the picking process and the chords. The banjo's open tuning, so when you strum it without any of the fingers down, it still sounds nice. And then the chords are just really, really wide and open, and all the strokes are down strokes. And so you get this really beautiful, like, harmonic sensation. I play a lot of different instruments, and this one in particular is just so, it's so homey feeling. And I think because of how the body sits so close and like all of it is in your lap, just feels so like close and familiar. I remember driving down 71 and headed south, and the melody just came to me, and the song, or like the first verse. Kinda like a cutie, you're like a little baby orange, taunting my sweet tooth, and you left me forlorn. Now I'm having some problems with your philosophy, because you look like an angel and sting me like a bee. And all of that kind of came to me at the same time, kind of in pieces, and it kind of ramshackled its way into my mind. And when you are somebody who gives your heart away a lot, and you're looking for people to receive it, I mean, I do remember a particular situation, but it's not rare for me to find that I'm drawn to different people and thinking about how relationships work and how friendships work. And but then the song kind of just grew into something like a little bit more all-encompassing about where you feel home and where I feel home. Kansas City, baby, what could I do? The roads here are wide and straight, but all I want is you. In all good relationships, there is push and pull, and that is what the romance is. You know, if it was so easy, it would be so boring, you know? And with Kansas City, there, it's not a love-hate, but there's this burning and this want. I love to travel, so I go around the world and I talk about coming from Kansas City, and they're like, oh, you're from Kansas, and I'm like, kinda, and you know, there's no place like home, and Toto, and blah, 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 and I'm like, ah, gosh, you guys don't get where I'm coming from. It's just this rare gem, it's this rare jewel, it's a secret, and it becomes my job to either tell them that there's something amazing and beautiful in the plains of America, or not. Skyline ain't a mountain high when you're living on true. I've traveled the world, oh, to find the most beautiful girl. So Catastrophe is my most recent release, and explores a kind of different vignettes of romance and the process of romance. So it starts with love at first sight, and then goes through the process of becoming more and more vulnerable, and then kind of assessing the situation, seeing that it probably isn't a good fit, and realizing that, being angry about it, and then moving on. Kansas City Baby, this song belongs to this record because it explores that concept of romance is not the most important kind of love. Sometimes you find people in relationships that sting more than they are sweet, and then going back and finding the things that root you and that ground you. And for me, that's the people that are here in Kansas City. Got the luggage I've been toting around, trinkets and milestones, but the best that I've found are the blessings and the proverbs. No, not some words, but the faces of loved ones. Now I haven't heard of Kansas City, baby. What could I do? Sick when I'm leaving it, but I'm coming home soon. Said I'm heartsick when I'm leaving it, but I'm coming home soon.
That was Calvin Arsenia talking about the song Kansas City Baby. It's on his latest album, Catastrophe. Thanks to KCUR's Andrea Tudhope for that installment in our Story of a Song series. Calvin is performing from his album this weekend at The Outburst, a venue in KCK. And that brings today's show to a close. You can listen back to anything you heard at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We talked about psychological thrillers, book covers, local music, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's all at kcur.org/centralstandard. And while you're there, scroll down and find our recent show about the word y'all. It's a fun one. So happy weekend listening, y'all. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.